Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. By the way, be sure to join us on Facebook at facebook.com/UNC Knowledge. facebook.com/UNC Knowledge. Chairman of the House Budget Committee, Congressman Paul Ryan, a Republican, has represented the 1st District of Wisconsin since 1999. A native of Janesville, Wisconsin, Congressman Ryan is a graduate of the University of Miami in Oxford, Ohio, and is notable, in my own view, for two particular attainments. In college, he worked for Oscar Mayer as a driver of the Wienermobile, and this past April, he presented the Path to Prosperity, also known as the Ryan Budget or the Ryan Proposal, which is, in my judgment, again, the most comprehensive conservative proposal for reform of the federal government since the contract with America of a generation ago. Now, Congressman Ryan is in California to talk about one aspect of his reform proposal, health care. Congressman Ryan, welcome to California.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me, Peter.
Segment one, Paul Ryan on Barack Obama. On February 25th, President Obama held a health care summit at Blair House across the street from the White House. You spoke up. Take just a moment.
We don't think the government should be in control of all of this. We want people to be in control. And that, at the end of the day, is the big difference. Now, we've offered lots of ideas all last year, all this year, because we agree the status quo is unsustainable. It's got to get fixed. It's bankrupting families. It's bankrupting our government. It's hurting families with pre-existing conditions. We all want to fix this, but we don't think that this is the answer to the solution. And all of the analysis we get proves that point. Now, I'll just simply say this, and I respectfully disagree with the Vice President about what the American people are or are not saying or whether we're qualified to speak on their behalf. So we are all representatives of the American people. We all do town hall meetings. We all talk to our constituents. And I've got to tell you, the American people are engaged. And if you think they want a government takeover of health care, I would respectfully submit you're not listening to them.
We'll come to health care, but here's the first question. Where do you come from? Where do you get off talking back to the President of the United States? Nobody would describe you as arrogant, but you sure are sure of yourself. Where does it come from?
Well, I'm a conservative. My thing is, I'm not trying to be somebody other than who I am. So I'm not trying to fake it. I'm just who I am. And it was very clear to me at that moment in that room, we were there for 6 or 7 hours, that what they were trying to do was sort of muddle the differences, sort of haze the moment and make it as if we just have subtle differences. That wasn't the case. We had sharp differences between our approaches to government, healthcare in particular. And I just wanted to basically enunciate that. And obviously, I don't think the president enjoyed listening to what I was saying.
He did not look happy.
Pretty clear. No,
he
was straight across
the reaction shot. He did not look happy.
So he didn't enjoy that. But look, these are co-equal branches of government. He's not the king. He's the president. He's elected just like the rest of us. So, from an institutional, constitutional standpoint, I don't worry or fear that someone is higher. We're all representatives of the people. We're in co-equal branches of government. So I just wanted to pass on to him what people were telling me that I represent.
Okay. You said in the clip that we just saw, I'm quoting you, we agree that the status quo, talking about the status quo in healthcare, is unsustainable. The United States spends 17% of its GDP on healthcare. The next nearest country, Switzerland, spends 11%.
Right.
Not even close to us, the next nearest country. And costs are rising faster than inflation. So President Obama says, here's Obamacare. Everybody gets health insurance. Mm-hmm. We're going to cover everybody, and we'll put in some regulation to hold down the costs. What's wrong with that?
Well, he could learn from the Swiss, actually. They have a private system. What he wants to do is erect a government-run system. And so rather than going straight toward a single-payer system, which is what he has always acknowledged he was for,
single-payer would be the government.
A socialized medicine system,
right.
A government-run system. This is sort of a two-step approach to it. And so what at the end of the day you're going to get out of this kind of a system are basically, I don't know, 5 or 6 really large insurance companies who are like public utilities, who are de facto run by the government, giving you different shades of the same color of insurance. And that just doesn't work. So it's sort of a fatal conceit, which is we've seen these ideas practiced around the country. It's this notion, and it's sort of the heart of progressivism, which is we in Congress will pass a vague law, and then we'll delegate all the power and the authority to these bureaucrats at the federal government who will micromanage these affairs of our lives, health care. It doesn't work. That is where the president's law takes us. And I, for one, would like to prevent this from happening versus watch this get rolled into law and see the system collapse. I have no doubt in my mind that this will collapse the quality and the cost of our health care system. And so I'd rather prevent that from happening versus trying to clean up the mess after all the collateral damage has occurred.
You don't want to pick and choose Obamacare. You want repeal.
Absolutely. Because the fundamental architecture is hollow. It's wrong. It is It is based upon a faulty premise that I think
Have you seen the we're recording this in late September. Have you seen the current issue of the Weekly Standard?
No, I haven't.
James Capra. Okay. I just got it.
Well, I know Jim real well.
He probably sent you an advanced copy of his piece.
I did see that article. Yeah. I have read the article. So, he and I talk quite a bit, and we were sort of very like-minded on this issue.
All right. So for all I know, you ghosted this for him. I don't know. Well, but there's an editorial saying that it's saying, in effect, we're, as we move into the presidential season, the big election year of 2012, Obamacare has fallen off the radar. Republicans have this notional position that they ought to repeal it, but only Ryan is out there saying anything about it. So he says that, I'm quoting now from the lead editorial in the Weekly Standard, that the House should right away begin, quote, bringing up repeal provisions one by one, beginning with the individual mandate. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea. I think we should probably, we have to wait till next year because we have, you know, this, I won't get into the minutia of scheduling in Congress, but this is clearly something we should be doing next year. Look, this election, this is going to be the most important election in our generation. I know it's a cliche people keep saying, this time is different, and healthcare is the center of it all. You cannot address this country's fiscal and economic problems unless you address healthcare. And so the president has put down his marker. He has made his law. And that law is going to dramatically transform America, just like the president said he aspired to do. And so this is going to be a huge issue next year. It's just a matter of time before this comes up. They now want to keep going with Metascare, which we have learned doesn't work. And we can confront this and we can champion this and beat this. It's really a question of who do you want to be in charge of healthcare, you or the government bureaucrats? That's really the big difference at the end of the day.
Can I just briefly... When Obamacare was enacted into law, you were then in the minority. You and Minority Leader Boehner and Eric Cantor held the Republican caucus together, right, and it didn't get a single vote. How hard was it to hold your Republicans together?
It was hard because there was a lot of political pressure from the bully pulpit and the president and from different constituencies to vote for this. It was basically people saying, healthcare's a big problem. Just vote for this fix. Even if you think it's flawed, vote for it. So it was difficult because a lot of members wanted to be seen as doing something. And so we had to articulate alternatives. We had to articulate why this was so fundamentally flawed. And when we dug into the guts of this law, which is a massive new law, it wasn't that difficult to explain and demonstrate to the country and to our members that this is really a deeply flawed piece of legislation. So it wasn't, at the end of the day, all that difficult, but it took us a little while to get there.
All right. Segment two, fixing it. You're calling for three fundamental reforms. One for Medicare, one for Medicaid, one for working Americans. Let's just take each one in turn. Medicare, the system that covers all Americans 65 and over. Quoting from remarks that you're going to deliver here in California later today, you may ad lib for all I know, but this is the way it reads in paper. Mm-hmm. Quote, in Medicare, patient-centered reform means premium support, close quote. Give me both of those. What's patient-centered reform, and why does it require premium support?
Patient-centered means the patient is the nucleus of the healthcare system, not the government, not the insurance bureaucrat. So with the patient-centered, that means all providers are competing against each other for the patient's business. Hospitals, doctors, insurance companies, forced into competition with one another for the person's benefit. Wherever we've tried this dynamic in the free economy, it's worked very, very well to bring down costs and increase quality. And this has also worked this way well in healthcare, in Medicare. The Part D benefit. People complain about how Part D got assembled.
Which is the prescription drug benefit.
This prescription drug benefit involves patient-centered. These are plans that are forced to compete against each other, and people get to choose among competing plans.
And that has cost less than
projected. It's cost 41% less than projected, and it's very high in satisfaction. Premium support means you'll have a list of guaranteed coverage options offered to you through Medicare, just like I, as a member of Congress, have as a federal employee, just like Medicare Advantage works for 20% of seniors. The senior chooses among the list of these guaranteed coverage options, and these plans compete against each other for their business. If the senior doesn't like her plan this year, she can fire it and go to another plan next year. And Medicare subsidizes the portion of her premium based on who she is. Is she sick or poor or middle income? She'll get a lot more of a subsidy. If she's a wealthy, healthy person, she won't get as much of a subsidy. And doing it that way, according to the Clinton Commission, according to a lot of other Democrats, according to the actuaries at HHS, makes the program solvent and sustainable. So this is an idea that has historically had bipartisan support among, I guess I'd say, more moderate Democrats. It's an idea that we put in our Path to Prosperity budget, and it's a way of saving Medicare. And the other part of it is you don't have to do this, put these kinds of reforms into the current generation. If you act now, you can prevent any change from a person 55 and above, and so it applies to those of us who are 54 and below. And I would simply argue, let's preempt a European austerity where we're cutting current seniors, raising taxes. Let's phase in reforms that are gradual, that have proven to work, that actually save the system and prevent the country from going off a debt cliff.
Okay. According to the Congressional Budget Office, 10 years after the enactment of your reform, the federal government would be spending $240 billion less per year on Medicare than it would under current law. How do they know that?
I understand.
If you say to me, I want to make this more, I want to take Medicare and do everything I can to make it look more like a market.
Right.
I say, great.
Yeah.
Everything I know about life and American history suggests that will help and save money.
Here's how.
But how do we know? Okay.
Here's how. Because it's going from a defined, open-ended defined benefit system to a defined contribution system. And because these are defined contributions, they're quantifiable. You can, how many people are going into Medicare, how much of the contribution. President Obama's law does the similar kind of thing, except he caps it globally and runs it from government. So President Obama is taking Medicare spending from here down to there. He's proposing a complicated formula, and then he's giving a board of 15 unelected bureaucrats called the Independent Payment Advisory Board the power to price control Medicare to lower those costs, to get those savings. So here's the difference. We are saying run the money through the individual based on their need so that they have the power to decide how their health care will be delivered to them, and you can chart those costs. The president is saying cap those costs as well, cut Medicare from its current growth rates, but give the power to 15 unelected bureaucrats to decide who gets what, when, where, and how. Very different approaches. Both of them recognize that Medicare is growing at an unsustainable rate. We say, let's do it through choice and competition revolving around the beneficiary, the patient. He says, I want these 15 bureaucrats I'm appointing next year to make all the decisions. So no one is suggesting Medicare can grow at the rate that it's growing at. That has a $37 trillion right. unfunded liability.
Even President Obama can't
Even President
say that
Obama
with a
is suggesting
face.
That right. that has right. to change. The difference is he wants unelected bureaucrats to make the shots, that we want patients to make the decisions.
Okay. Back to the Weekly Standard. Is Yuval Levin a friend as well?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So again, who knows? Maybe you've already read this, or for all I know.
I've read Capretta's. He sent it over.
Okay, but, so yeah. Yuval Levin, in the current issue of the Weekly Standard, your reform gets attacked from the right. I imagine that's a novel experience.
I've heard
for you.
It all.
Have you heard it all?
I've heard everything from everybody.
Okay, so here's you. But he makes the point that under your reform proposal, it is still the government that is establishing the floor benefit.
That's right.
Minimum
That's
benefit. Right. Okay. And he says, Yuval Levin has a better idea. Have a better idea. And I have to say, as I read the article yesterday, it did sound like a better idea. Forgive
great.
Me, but it did sound
no,
like a better
great.
Idea. So the notion here is that Medicare, the government should define what it wants, the level of care that it wants
right.
as the minimum, go out to each of the Medicare regions and invite bidding. And then choose the second least expensive, second most inexpensive, so to speak, so that on the defined contribution to the 65-year-old, there's always in his or her region one plan that's less expensive, that enables him to put money in his pocket, one plan that just takes every dollar and provides perfectly adequate support, and then an array of plans for which he or she can chip in a little extra.
That's just an improvement upon our idea. Our idea is our plan doesn't preclude any of that.
No, it doesn't preclude it?
Yeah, not at all.
So you have
not
no
at
objection
all.
At
no,
all?
No, not at all. No, our plan gives you the basic framework of how a premium support system would work, what it would cost, and then when you implement such a system, those are the kinds of details that you grapple with in how to design a very good functioning market-based premium support system. So Yuval, that's perfectly complementary with what we're talking about.
So Yuval Levin, mere details. Nice idea. We'll discuss it later. Is that the correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, fine. Segment three, fixing it, continue. We've discussed Medicare. We just spent 6 minutes talking about this massive...
It's more than I usually get.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's usually like about 30 seconds, so I appreciate the 6 minutes.
Okay. Medicaid, program that provides health insurance to the poor. Again, I'm quoting from your prepared remarks. Quote, in Medicaid, patient-centered reform means block grants to state governments, close quote. Why is that the big reform?
Well, first of all, there's a federalism component to this. States already manage Medicaid. The federal government, you know, pays for a portion of it through a complicated formula. And so there's a states' rights issue here, number one. Why not let 50 different, you know, incubators of ideas come up with these things? Number two, what states could do, Tom Coburn, Devin Nunes, and Richard Burr and I championed legislation in the past called the Patient's Choice Act, which says let's just voucher out Medicaid so that people on Medicaid get additional assistance on top of refundable tax credits, which is where we're probably going next in this conversation, so that they too can get private health insurance like everybody else. We think that instead of having the government sort of top down say, here is exactly how this program now will be run from Washington, which right now it's not, it's run by our states, give the states the ability to manage and reform their programs. And one of the options I think they could, and I've talked to many governors who want to do this, would be to stop segregating poor people into inferior care. You know, where they go into the doctor's office with sort of poor person stamped to their forehead, they're in Medicaid, and more doctors won't even see Medicaid patients anymore because they lose money every time they see one of them. They get paid about 60 cents on the dollar. And so this is a program that's breaking. It's ripping apart by its seams. The president's health care law just increased it by a third, and that is just going to hasten the collapse of the Medicaid system. And so we really fundamentally believe that you let the governors come up with better ideas on how to fix these problems. Lots of governors have been innovative in how to do this. And one of the ideas that I think governors ought to consider is don't have them in some separate system that's just for low-income individuals. Mainline them into the private health insurance system where they, too, can choose with additional resources private health insurance like everybody else. So the next time they go in the doctor's office, they're indistinguishable from anybody else.
Okay. And so now tell me, as a conservative, I get happy about this for what reasons? First of all, because the federal government is just giving money to the states. So there's a federalism. The states do better. And the federal government knows what it's spending. It knows
its
costs.
That's right. So it caps the costs. So we know exactly how much we'll be spending in Medicaid because block grants are set at a fixed formula.
Okay, but so what about the argument, the compassionate conservative, the argument that even as a conservative president, George W. Bush, felt compelled, I'll let you add any gloss on that you want to, but felt compelled to enact No Child Left Behind legislation because when it came right down to it, there were always going to be states that did a bad job of educating.
Yeah, see, I just disagree with that whole concept. So,
let's hear it.
Either we're going to have this sort of paternalistic approach from Washington that we know best. We're going to trample on states' rights, or we're going to acknowledge states' rights as our founders did, and we're going to cut the strings and send the dollars back to the states where they came from in the first place, and let the states figure out how to fix their problems. Look, I come from Wisconsin. It's a little different than California, which is different than Nevada, New Mexico, and Colorado, and Oklahoma, and everybody else. So one size does not fit all. It's a little arrogant to assume that this program, which is really a state-run program right now, will be far better managed if we in Washington take it over. I mean, think of the arrogance of that kind of a concept, which is where I think the president's health care law goes.
Right.
And so let the states figure this out.
All right. Your third major reform, and again, to quote from your prepared remarks, quote, with regard to health insurance for working Americans, patient-centered reform means replacing the inefficient tax treatment of employer-provided health care with a portable, refundable tax credit that you can take with you from job to job,
right.
Close quote. Give me that in layman's terms.
Okay, so when we get health care from our job because of a regulatory ruling going back to World War II, we don't pay taxes on that benefit. So our health care benefits are tax-free, but our wages are taxed. And so what's happening these days is this, I would argue, is one of the primary drivers of inflation in health care because it is insulating us from the cost of our coverage. Point number one. Point number two, if we let a worker decide between wages and benefits, they'll make a better comparison as to what is in their best interest if they're both taxed at the same level. Point number three is we spend, I think it's about, I'm doing this off the top of my head, about 3.5 spend. I shouldn't say we spend. The government, through this tax benefit, it's about $3.5 trillion over the next 10 years. You could do a far better job of allowing people to keep this money in their first place so that it's not attached to the job but attached to the worker. Because what happens if you lose your job? What happens if you decide to go strike it out on your own and start a new business? This benefit is tied to your job. So it's job-based benefits in a 21st century where you don't have the same job for the rest of your life. In the 20th century, when they put this in place, it may have made sense because you have one job for your entire career. That is not how it works these days. So why not de-link this tax benefit from the job and reattach it to the individual so that they can move through society in a portable way without losing this benefit if they lose their job?
Okay, that sounds pretty good. But you just said that all of these problems we have in healthcare arise from this, effectively, yes, this mistake that we made, that the federal government made during the Second World War. And last night, preparing for this program, guess what I discovered?
What?
Milton Friedman wrote about this years ago.
I know.
That there are no new ideas, only ideas Milton Friedman had that we haven't enacted yet.
That's right.
But so it's the Second World War. The government has imposed wage and price controls.
This is a valve of escape, so the companies
are now fighting for labor mm-hmm. and they begin providing health care as a fringe benefit. Becomes very, very popular. By the time the IRS realizes there's income being shoved out in the form of health benefits without being taxed, by now there's political support for this.
All right.
So the federal government screwed up
exactly
70 years ago.
Yes.
So why don't you listen? You're saying that we face a major. Why don't you just fix that?
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but Milton Friedman, quote, I have a quote here from Milton for you, Congressman. The ideal way to reform health care would be to reverse past actions, repeal the tax exemption of employer-provided medical care, and terminate Medicare and Medicaid. And your answer is, as the most articulate conservative in Congress, that horse has left the barn.
I'm a big fan of Uncle Milty, but also I'm a fan of I'm also a fan of Burke and other conservative lodestars. And so I guess in a Burkean conservative way, if you want to channel conservatives here, that horse has left the barn. We are where we are. Let's fix the system before it gets out of our control. If we do not address the root drivers of health inflation, which is really the problem we have here, you will have a debt crisis in this country. Our government will grow to unsustainable, unprecedented levels, and therefore it will have to tax or borrow at unprecedented levels, and you will end prosperity as we've known it in this country. And so what I mean when I say that is this healthcare issue is a product of several flaws, unintended consequences, from government policy, which has given rise to this third-party payment system where you don't know what things cost because you don't pay for the bills, and you don't care what they cost because someone else is paying for the bills.
Right.
And so you need to reconnect the producer and the consumer, the provider and the patient into relationships where there's a real shopping incentive. Instead of having 15 bureaucrats at IPAB twist the screws and the price controls to try and get at health inflation, why don't we empower a bottom-up consumer revolution with 300 million Americans going to their providers and demanding price and quality competition like we do in every other aspect of our economy. In order to get to that moment, a patient-centered system, market-driven, you have to address these massive market imperfections that are provided by the government. And that's exactly what I'm talking about doing.
Okay. And while we're conducting a seance, I can tell you that Uncle Milty would approve because two or three years before he died, I was in a meeting with him where people were suggesting reforms of this nature. And he said, that would be very good.
Still not ideal. I never met the man.
Still not ideal. Yeah,
I've read all his books. I've never met the guy.
So the question that you're making a judgment about what can be done given the reality of the situation,
where we
given
are.
The political reality. Okay, so here we go. Segment four, the politics. Once again, from your prepared remarks for later today, quote, we can win these fights. The challenge will be to summon the courage to offer the nation a true choice of two futures on health care. Close quote. All the American people have to do is understand what you're putting forward, and they'll support it.
I'm not confident enough to say all we have to do is explain it better and they'll support it, but I'm comfortable enough to say, let's give them the choice. Look, here's the way I see it. We need to kick this thing upstairs to the American people. You know, no 12-member supercommittee is going to solve all the country's problems by Thanksgiving, nor should they. This is one of the most precarious moments in our country because of the debt crisis we have, because of the fact that these programs are quickly becoming unstable and they're giving us an explosion of debt. We owe it to the country to say, if you don't like the path that we are on today, which the president has accelerated us down toward, I would say, a cradle-to-grave welfare state path, which is a managed decline, debt crisis-laden path, we have a moral obligation, if we don't like that path, to articulate very specific alternatives using our principles, the founding principles, and showing what that world looks like. Okay. So that the country can choose. And then the country gets to decide what kind of country we want to be and what kind of people we want to be for the 21st century. Because the decisions we make in the next 2 to 3 years, they will totally determine the kind of America we're going to have for literally this century.
Okay, so here I am. I'm not the chairman of the House Budget Committee. I'm a member of your committee, a junior member of your committee, or I'm a political consultant thinking about running a senatorial campaign in Pennsylvania or Ohio, or I'm advising a presidential candidate. And what I need to decide is, what I need to figure out is Ryan right in the middle? Is he describing and articulating what we can actually act upon? Or is he, and God bless him for this if this is the case, but or is he way out there on the edge?
Right.
And from my point of view, he's a probe, he's a test. We'll see how the political, all right. So here, let me give you a couple of data points. Asked this past May to name the Democrats' top three issues in 2012, former Speaker, that former just makes it all tenable, doesn't it? Former Speaker Nancy Pelosi replied, and I quote, Medicare, Medicare, and Medicare, close quote. Yuval Levin, in this article in the Weekly Standard, the current issue of the Weekly Standard, writes, and again I quote, congressional Democrats and President Obama have vilified Ryan's proposed reform. The more I read this stuff, the more you grin. So we'll get to your answer in a second. An assault on seniors and seem intent on making the prospect of such an assault a centerpiece of their 2012 campaign strategy, close quote. And, last point, not a single Republican presidential candidate has endorsed your path
That's
to prosperity.
Huntsman's endorsed it. Perry has said very, very encouraging things about it.
Well,
I didn't mean to cut you off.
Encouraging
there,
things. Okay, no, I'm so, John Huntsman. Okay, we'll carve out a little special. We'll put up our little John Huntsman statue here. Michelle Bachmann, who is out there for the, you'd think that she'd be the first to, and she has been very careful to keep some distance between her colleague Paul Ryan and his Medicare proposals.
Look,
so where are you?
I can't
wait
for
this. Are you
debate.
The cutting edge?
I look forward to this debate. We have this debate. Our job, as we see it, is to get this debate going, is to get the country talking about the big issues that will determine the future of this country.
And when you say our, you're talking about yourself and Eric Cantor
House,
and the Speaker?
Those of us in the House. Those of us, Republicans control one thing, the House of Representatives.
Got it. Okay.
And so that's what I mean when
the
I say
House.
That.
All right.
Look, either we give the country a choice of two futures or we just go down the path we are on. I feel we have a moral obligation. Whether this is going to work politically or not, it doesn't really matter. All I want to know is that I can look myself in the face, in the mirror, look my kids in the eyes, and know that I did everything I can to stop this country from going off a cliff. And more importantly, what I learn is this Medicare stuff doesn't work. So here's the key point. This is the last vestige of an intellectually bankrupt party or of a party that is more interested in clouding the issues and diffusing and disguising really what it is they're trying to do or where they're taking the country. So all we have to do is do a better job of getting the facts and the truth out about what it is. What this demagoguery and this Medicare is basically attempting to do, it's sort of shoot the messenger. Win the debate by default. Sort of nullify the notion that there's an actual alternative path for the country. And so what we'll see in this kind of a debate is an attempt to sort of, demagogue, distort, or deny through strawman arguments that there's actually a coherent alternative to the path that they have placed us upon. And I, for one, believe Americans are hungry for that. I think they want to see that kind of leadership, and they want to know that if we reapply these founding principles, which gave us the American idea in the first place, we can get this country back on track. Most Americans believe the country's way off on the wrong track. And so I, for one, you know, look, the district I represent went for Dukakis, Clinton, Gore, and Obama. So, and I've been running on these ideas for years. So it's not as if a person cannot survive politically by putting these things out there. I've been
Marco Rubio in Florida,
endorsing the roadmap, which was the precursor to all of this.
Right.
He put both arms around it. So
okay.
People want to be talked to like adults, not like children. And when they are, I think they respond. And what we've learned in these last two congressional elections, these two special elections in Nevada and New York, is that if we have the courage of our convictions, if we defend our ideas, we will win the debate.
All right. So whatever the politics, Paul Ryan will not be cowed.
Yeah. I mean, look, we owe it to the country to give them a choice.
Paul Ryan on the floor of the House.
Mr. Speaker, the American people are tired of all the accounting tricks and the budget gimmicks that go on in Washington. Let me explain what $1.3 trillion of this does. It says that imagine that we're at war for 10 years in Afghanistan and Iraq at surge levels. We assume we're going to be fighting this war for 10 more years with over 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. And oh, gosh, wait. We're going to withdraw our troops in 2014. $1 trillion in savings. I've got a better idea. Let's pass a bill to cover the moon with yogurt that will cost $5 trillion today. And then let's pass a bill the next day to cancel that bill. We could save $5 trillion. Wait, I got a better idea. Our debt is $14 trillion. Let's come up with a new plan to spend $14 trillion, then rescind it the next day, and let's save $14 trillion. This stuff is fiscal fantasy. You can't make this stuff up, Mr. Speaker. Suggesting that we're going to be in a war at these levels for 10 more years when everybody knows we've already decided not to do that, that does not get us $1.3 trillion in spending cuts. Only in Washington can you add up math like that. We need real spending cuts. I yield myself an additional minute to say, this is getting serious, Mr. Speaker. Very serious.
It is getting serious. Milton Friedman, Uncle Milty, identified the problem. James Buchanan and others have done work on it. And the problem runs as follows. It's very easy to describe. The benefits of federal spending accrue to specific groups who therefore have an incentive to organize politically and agitate for more and more and more spending, whereas the costs of federal spending are diffused across the whole population, so nobody has a counterbalancing incentive to organize against more federal spending. So I look at that tape and I'm thrilled. This is just for somebody who started out in the Reagan White House to see somebody standing up these years later and saying exact Ronald Reagan, as long as we're conducting the seance here, Ronald Reagan somewhere is smiling. But you fix Medicare and you fix Medicaid if you're lucky. And then 5 years later, the federal government has overspent yet again.
Yeah.
And again, so where is the structural reform? What can be done to fix the underlying imbalance in incentives?
This, in a nutshell, is our moral dilemma. This is pretty much it. A lot of people have written about this. Buchanan, Mansur Olson wrote about this. A lot of people have written about this from different perspectives. That's it right there. And so we're reaching this tipping point in this country where we'll have more takers than makers, where we'll have a majority of citizens more net dependent upon the government for their livelihoods, and then they therefore vote for those benefits. And the makers in society are a shrinking pool, and you have a very ugly situation on your hands. You have a stagnant economy. You have a divisive society. You have a cultural decline. You have sort of a European austerity situation on your hands.
We turn into Greece.
And don't think that this can't happen here. It can. Each generation has an obligation to prevent that from happening if we want to stay true to our founding. And so we're going in that direction. So structural, what do you do? This is why we advocate for individual-based ideas, for free market economics, for economic freedom, for free market democracy. And that's why you had to deal with this healthcare issue the way we're talking about it. That's why we believe in fundamental tax reform. That's why we believe in devolving power back to the states. That's why we believe in fixing this federal budget process to prevent the largesse from continuing on and from putting an inherent incentive and bias in our system, like those kinds of budget gimmicks, which make it easy to tax and spend more money and borrow.
So your hope is generational.
Yeah.
For seven decades, Americans have been taught to rely on the federal government, first for old age pensions, then for health, now for food stamps, on and on. And your hope is that by changing these programs, right, not eliminating them,
That's right.
Living up to Milton Friedman's ideal of wiping out
Correct.
Seven decades
Correct.
Of legislation, but by changing them, you can begin instructing new generations in individual liberty.
That's right. That's exactly right. So the way I describe it is we want to have a safety net to catch people who cannot help themselves and to help people who are down on the luck get back on their feet. We don't want to turn the safety net into a hammock that lulls people into lives of dependency and complacency. And so the way our defined benefit, government benefits are designed, number one, they're demographically driven, so they're going to explode in cost and
right.
therefore debt. But number two, they're more or less tooled in such a way as to keep people on the dole, to keep people on dependency.
Right.
And so if that's the agenda, which is if you're from the party of government, if you're a progressive that believes the government needs to be much larger than it is, that the principle at the horizon you're shooting for is one of equality of outcome, not equality of opportunity, then keep going down the path we're on. But if you believe in opportunity society with a safety net, where the government's role is to protect our natural rights and promote equal opportunity so you can make the most of your lives and be happy however you design it, then you have to get back on this kind of a path.
You are not just in the business of cutting. You are in the business of creating opportunities for the development of character.
Exactly.
Segment five, our final segment, the man from Janesville, the Wisconsin first. George W. Bush carried the district with 53% of the vote in 2008. Barack Obama carried the district with not quite 52%
right.
of the vote last time around. You know, if a political scientist just had listened to you talk up to this point, he'd say Orange County or someplace Oklahoma, or maybe this is the at-large representative from Wyoming. That guy comes from a safe conservative mm-hmm. district. You don't. How do you do it?
I don't say anything different at home than what I'm saying to you right here. And this is exactly who I am. That's the key. Don't try to be somebody you're not. And you know what? If you don't get elected, you don't get elected. Big deal. I mean, if you want to be good at these jobs, you got to be willing to lose the job. And I get this all the time. You know, I was at Stop and Go gassing up the other day.
At home?
Yeah, at home. I live in Janesville. I live on the block I grew up on. You know,
really?
I come from a big Irish Catholic family. We all live in the same neighborhood. In my town, I think John McCain got 33 or 35% of my hometown in Janesville. It's not a Republican area. What people always, I had a guy come to me and said, you know what, I don't always agree with everything you do, but I can tell you're trying and you're sincere, and that's what matters to me. So what I believe is people want conviction politicians. They want people who aren't just giving them vague platitudes. They want somebody trying to tackle these problems because people just know in their guts. They don't know the specifics necessarily. They know that we're going off the rails. They know that this country is in deep trouble. And, you know, look, we beat John Kerry in 2008 because most people couldn't relate to him in Wisconsin, in my area. You come and say Lambert Field and it's kind of over with. but traditionally our area votes Democrat on top of the ticket. I think we're going to change that because I think people are hungry for solutions and they know the direction we're heading is just not the right direction.
Okay.
And they want people who are standing up and doing something about it.
Two quotations. This will take a moment to set up and then I'll just stand back and let you reflect on it. Two quotations. First, you. Again, from your prepared remarks. Last time you have to listen to this. Quote, the urgent need to deal with the drivers of our debt will present us with an unavoidable time for choosing. Close quote. Well, I like that phrase, a time for choosing.
Right.
Reagan's 64
right.
speech, you did that intentionally. Mm-hmm. You make it sound like a wonderful opportunity. Here's the second quotation. Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal last weekend. He's talking about Europe. He's saying that reform is going to happen, but it's going to happen slowly and be a
ugly.
Ugly. Yeah. Quote, sadly, a similar destiny probably lies ahead for the U.S. only after a series of panics, quite possibly destructive ones, will politicians have leeway seriously to address the unsustainability of the current welfare state. Every move will be too little to ward off another crisis, another showdown, and potentially decades of political strife and economic uncertainty. And as we sit here, the Senate just last night came up with some new cockamamie set of procedures to keep the government running until November. Right, you have to go back to Washington to vote on it on Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah.
All right, so there's another showdown. So what's it going to be? If we win the House and the Senate and the White House, let's just stipulate we win next year. Can we just fix it? Or
yes.
Is this country in for decades of struggles?
This is exactly how I read Holman's, I've never met Holman, I think I met him once, but I read his piece. This is exactly how I see it. And this is why I just deeply believe we need to make this a referendum and let the country choose. That way, if we win the election based upon these very specific ideas and principles, we have the obligation and moral authority to enact these reforms to prevent that kind of austerity from occurring.
We don't have to become Europe.
We don't have to become Europe, but we will very soon. Look, I talked to a lot of economists and fixed income people and all these things. They basically tell us we got 2 to 5 years, probably closer to two based upon the way things are going, before we have our own austerity plan, before we have our own debt crisis. And when you're the world's reserve currency, this could be ugly. We would not have an elegant decline like, say, France. We would have a very choppy, volatile, ugly decline, and it's totally avoidable. It is completely preemptible. So the way I see it is it's all about confidence and trajectory, which is, are we getting get the trajectory of our debt and our deficits under control so our economy can be free and so it can grow and prosper? You know, are we going to go back and implement those ideas that make us that opportunity society, that upward mobility society? And do we have, are we putting that plan in place? And are we confident that we're going to reach this trajectory? We will be confident if we change the structure of government, the structure of these programs that are the drivers of these debts. And that means we have to win an affirming election where the country gives us the authority and the obligation to do this. If we don't, if we go into this election with just a personality contest, muddling the differences, just speeding each other up, then it's going to be ugly afterwards, no matter who wins. And if we fail, then at least we tried. And so that's the way I see it.
Okay. So 2012 matters. Paul Ryan.
A lot of people try to convince me that I should jump in this race. As you can tell, that the race has not formed fully yet. My answer really hadn't changed. If I really wanted one for president, I would have done it months ago. And I think in any job in politics, you can have balance with your family, but I'm not so sure you can do that with this particular job. And so I just couldn't get over that. And when other people want you to run for president more badly than you yourself do, I think that kind of says something.
Okay. Last night, we put up on Facebook a notice that I'd be interviewing you today and invited people to put up questions. I checked 34 minutes after we put up the notice. Dozens of people had already put up comments. And here you go. Stephen Delapena, quote, ask why he's so awesome. That's the good part. And why he's only sharing that awesomeness with his family in southeastern Wisconsin.
Right.
Chase Murphy, I think it is borderline irresponsible for a Republican who could clean Obama's clock to choose not to run. R.J. Mueller, ask him why he doesn't just cut the routine and team up with Chris Christie to win this thing. And I got an email from Paul Ray, Professor Paul Ray of Hillsdale.
Ricochet,
You know Paul. And here's what Paul wanted me to read to you. Quote, what an opportunity we have been given, and what will it mean if we waste it? Congressman?
No pressure. Yeah. That's that clip basically is what I think, how I feel. You know, it's not as if one person is we can do this. And I don't feel like I have to be the vessel on top of the ticket in 2012 to do this. As far as I'm concerned, from the House, we've done a lot to frame this debate. We've done a lot to move this conversation to where it belongs, and we can do more to do that. But just like I said there, you have to have it in your mind, in your heart, in your gut to so badly want to be president to run effectively for it, and I just don't have that. So,
yeah, but
you know,
that's
maybe
what
it's
qualifies
because
you. You're the one sane man who's in a position to... Okay, so I won't... Look, far be it from me. I've never run for dog catcher. I'm not going to beat you up over that, but let me ask one more question about the presidential field. And I understand that whoever gets elected, and let's hope one of these fellows does, fellows are, in Michelle Bachmann's case, woman, you've got to work with them. So I understand that maybe you're not going to want to close with this question in quite the way that I might hope, but so let's just stipulate that. Do what you can with it. So Rick Perry, governor of Texas, calls Social Security a Ponzi scheme. And he's right. It's just, as a matter of fact, a Ponzi scheme is a scheme under which you pay off earlier investors with the money of newer investors. And Social Security pays off retirees with the money of the current working generation. And as there are more and more retirees and fewer in the working generation, the scheme will blow up, as Ponzi schemes always do. And so he just expresses a home truth about one piece of our collapsing welfare state. And Mitt Romney attacks him for it and says, this is unwise. You're scaring the American people. This is not what our candidate should be doing. And all the other presidential candidates up on that stage look at their fingernails, glance down at their shoe shine, stare off innocently into space. And that is the level of discourse that we are receiving from our presidential candidates right now. Mitch Daniels, governor of Indiana,
I'm a big
good
fan
buddy
of
yours, said a couple of weeks ago, no Republican candidate is saying what needs to be said. Do you agree?
I think they will. I think time will occur. Time will heal these problems. And I think we have done a lot in the House to advance this debate.
Okay.
Because they won't be able to run away from what we've already done. And I'm fine if people don't like the way we propose to solve the problem. Use these conservative principles, apply them to the problem, and come up with a different, you know, route of solving these problems. That's great. I think that's going to have to happen. And I think these candidates will get there. It's still in the relatively early stages of this race, and I think they'll end up getting there.
Okay, last question. We've been talking about the challenges for this republic, the wider decline of Western civilization. Last question. Can the Packers pull it off again this year?
Absolutely.
You didn't even let me answer that.
I knew where you were going. I could see it. I could see the gleam
you
in your eye.
See it coming? Okay.
We feel pretty good about it. We feel like we have a dynasty on our hands.
And it's Lambeau Field.
It's Lambeau Field.
And
we feel like we have a dynasty.
Do
not come to Wisconsin and say Lambert Field.
Okay. Congressman Paul Ryan, chairman for now, and apparently if you're intent on staying in the House for some time to come of the House Budget Committee, thank you. I'm Peter Robinson for Uncommon Knowledge. Thanks for joining us.